here to the next in our CMRS lecture series, where we have the visit of Jane Burns, Emerita of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, now living in the astonishing city of Taos, New Mexico, who is coming to talk to us about medieval culture, material culture, and her research. And to introduce Professor Burns properly, we have Sarah Grace Heller, Professor of French. So please welcome Sarah Grace.
Thank you. So you could take this little moment, if you have difficulty hearing over there, you could slide over a little bit and make sure that there are handouts over here. You might want to grab one during the little introduction here. It's a really deep honor to be able to introduce E. Jane Burns today and to be among you all. I want to thank you all for coming. It's good to see people interested in many different fields, and I think that's what you inspired, Jane, material culture and French and medieval and gender and all kinds of problems. Mutants, too. We'll talk about mutants today. Professor Boone said, she's recently retired as the Drusilla French Distinguished Professor of Women and Gender Studies at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. She began her career, interestingly, by going where few dared to go, taking on the vast and largely neglected old French prose romances in a book called Arthurian Fictions, Rereading the Vulgate Cycle, which was actually published in 1985 by our own Ohio State University Press.
Thank you.
She was able to see rhyme and reason and structure and program where others had merely seen sprawl. And this is one of the things I really admire about her is the way that she comes in and rereads and inspires us to continue rereading and putting characters in dialogue who maybe hadn't then, but who allow us to see things from a different perspective. In about 1986, she became one of the so-called founding co-mothers, in a wonderful moniker, of the Society for Medieval Feminist Scholarship. And the course of her inquiries at that point turned toward gender in the ways that characters deprived of voices still managed to speak in a book called Body Talk, When Women Speak in Old French Literature, which came out in 1993. A further turn towards the expressive power of textiles and garments is seen in publications such as Courtly Love Undressed, Reading Through Clothes in Medieval French Culture from 2002, and Sea of Silk, a textile geography of women's work, which came out in 2009. She's also edited a number of volumes and written lots of articles, she continues to ponder multiple ways of reading. I was talking to a colleague recently and kind of mentioned this visit upcoming, and his immediate reaction was, Jane, she's one of the great lights of the profession. And I love that because I think of you and I think of light, and we thought of moving to Taos in retirement, the land of extraordinary light. And I agreed and recalled that I recalled no conversation from which I did not come away improved from having been in her enthusiastic and optimistic presence. So you've been an inspiration to me for a long time. I think this was reflected in the Society for Medieval Feminist Studies interest in mentoring too. That there's an interest in supporting new generations of scholars, an interest in hearing voices. So I think there are many current scholars who count themselves in Professor Burns' debt. So it's a very great pleasure to welcome her today to speak on the peculiar genetic and dynastic force that was Mélusine. Her talk today is entitled Mermaids in Material Culture, Looking Eastward from Medieval France. Please join me in welcoming E. Jane Burns.
Thank you, Sarah Grace, for that wonderful introduction. I was a little worried there when Jane is one of the light, I was hoping you were going to say lightweight scholars of medieval culture. Anyway, it's a pleasure to be here. I really hadn't expected that my first book would be published by Ohio State University Press. And I never imagined that I would get a chance to speak here. So it's kind of a nice bookend to my career to start with your university and end here, because I think this is probably the last public lecture I'll give as a medievalist. So I'm looking forward to it. And I want to thank in particular the Center for Medieval and Renaissance Studies for being kind enough to invite me. And I guess that's it. We should start. So let me just start by saying, can everyone hear me, first of all? Can you hear over there? Okay. Readers familiar with the story of Mélusine, the 15th century heroine of Jean d'Arras's text called La Noble Histoire de Lusignan, know this politically capable, courtly mother to be marvelous and wondrous because of a few highly distinctive features. She has a snake tail, at least while bathing on Saturdays, and she can fly, at least at a few key moments in the narrative. In fact, however, the initial wonder and awe expressed by characters in this romance when they first encounter Mélusine has nothing to do with her hybrid body or her supernatural abilities. Courtly onlookers who attend the wedding of Mélusine and Raymond, the Count of Poitiers, are struck instead by the bride's sumptuous riches, her extravagant wealth, registered in particular in ornate textiles and jewels. Wedding guests are led to, and this is number one on the handout, a tent adorned with gold and precious gems, so ornate that everyone was awestruck, and I've underlined this word, the verb émerveiller, which comes back over and over, and we'll see that in all of these quotes that are on the beginning part of the handout. So everyone was awestruck by the tent's extravagance. Although the beauty of the bride is remarked, it is also her sumptuous attire and the opulence of her garments that strike wonder into the audience. And that's number two on the handout, and the same verb, émerveiller, comes back. They were all amazed by her excessive beauty and the great expense of her clothing. To be sure, these features can be read as requisite markers of Mélusine's courtly extravagance. At one point, Mélusine is even cast in terms some of you might recognize from the portrait of Marie de Champagne in the iconic courtly, as the iconic courtly patron invoked in the prologue to Chrétien de Troyes' 12th century romance, the Chevalier de la Charette. I included this because I assume some of you might be familiar with this text. There, the courtly lady is said to be worth more than silks and jewels. When Chrétien asks rhetorically, this is number three on the handout, would I ever say, just as a precious gem is worth so much silk cloth and chalcedony, thus is the countess worth so many queens? Then, of course, he goes on to say, no, I would never say that after he said it. But the part I'm interested in is the comparison between the queen and jewels and silks. In Jean d'Arras' account, Mélusine's worth is characterized similarly in comparison to the jewels of royalty, and that's number four on the handout. The countess herself affirmed that in all the world, no queen, king, or emperor was rich enough to possess wealth equal in value to the jewels Mélusine was wearing. Much like the courtly King Arthur and the stereotypically generous Alexander the Great, to whom Arthur is regularly compared in 12th century romance texts, Mélusine in Jean d'Arras' tale bestows costly gems on the knights and ladies, squires and young ladies who attend her own kind of woodland court. And yet, onlookers at the wedding remain suspicious of the source of these lavish gifts and the woman who bestows them, and that's number five on the handout. They were all in awe, and that's that verb, émerveiller again, they were all in awe of where so much wealth could come from. No one ever wonders this about King Arthur. Although the wealth associated with Mélusine is recognizable and reassuring as a sign of her courtliness, that is, it is wondrous in the sense of being appropriately spectacular and compelling, her extravagant riches are also troubling to Raymond's entourage. This ostensibly courtly woman's wealth seems also to Mark something else, something unknown. Even to Raymond, who fails to answer his follower's persistent question, tell us at least who this woman is and what is her lineage. So we are confronted perhaps most directly with the strangeness of Melusine's wealth in an important passage that has received little attention, and that's number 6 on the handout. I want to dwell on that for a few minutes. In the narrative's description of the chapel where Raymond and Melusine are wed, the richness of lavish decoration in gold and pearls is said to be estrange, a word that can mean odd or unusual, but also unfamiliar, unknown, or even foreign. The passage begins with typical courtly hyperbole, stating that, this is passage number 6, the chapel was so lavishly decorated that no one could evaluate its worth. And then it shifts, the sentence shifts seamlessly to the liturgical wealth of the decorative textiles that the chapel contains. The vestments or the garments or the textiles or whatever we want to call them, these ornate textiles, were most strangely and richly decorated in gold and embroidery with pearls, so that no one had ever seen their equal. This language recalls the sumptuous and exceptional embroidery done by fairies like Morgan le Fay in earlier old French romances, and thus reinforces indirectly the possible fairy dimension of this heroine. But the passage also contextualizes the strange and costly embroidered garments with the equally ornate setting of liturgical objects. We're told specifically that the chapel's lavish decoration results as much from the strangely worked vestments or textiles as from the statues or sculptures, crosses, incense burners in gold and silver, or liturgical books that were as precious as one might hope. These objects delineate the realm of the bishop, who appears in the very last sentence of number 6 on the handout. He's mentioned in the final sentence in the passage as the official who performs... Oh, my goodness. My pages are out of order. Hold on. I certainly hope they're here somewhere. Hold on for just a second. Here we go. This is what happens when you kind of review part of your text and not the whole thing. All right, here we go. The official who performs the marriage ceremony. The bishop is in fact the person who wears some of those vestments or textiles of inestimable value that have been so richly and so strangely worked. Those garments, along with the crosses, statues, and liturgical books, signal a world in which we might least expect to find representations of the snake-tailed Melusine. And yet, it turns out that it's not unusual for medieval liturgical garments and other material objects owned and used by church officials to contain secular images, even images of monsters or mermaids. We know, for example, of at least three, this is one of them, three bishops' mitres decorated with a mermaid, all of which are likely made at the workshop of Roger II in Palermo in the 12th century. One of them, this is currently held at the Abbe Stiftung Museum in Germany, has a double-tailed siren. You can't really see it from here. So this is what the congregation looks at. This is the back of the mitre that's facing everybody. There's a circular image right there, which is this. It's turned, she's turned on her side, so you would have to look sideways to see it. I've turned it around for you. But, so it's a double-tailed mermaid on the back of this bishop's mitre. The textile of the mermaid herself is from the 13th century, so it was added somewhat later. We also have a pair of bishop's gloves, thought also to come from the same workshop in Palermo. And you can see here that there are two roundels up near the fingers, And each of them contains a mermaid. I'll show you a close-up in a minute. The other thing I want to draw your attention to here, though, which will come back later in the talk, is the elaborate purling. There are double, and this was characteristic of this workshop in Palermo. There are double rows of actual pearls down here at the bottom. This is pearls all the way around here. All of those tiny things are pearls that have been sewn on. So pearls played an incredible role in the production of textiles from this workshop in Palermo. But there, too, is the mermaid. So there are three mitres, there are these gloves, there are bishop's slippers, there are many objects of liturgical vestments that have mermaids on them from the 12th and 13th century. These material objects record a facile crossover between sacred and secular ornamentation in the early Middle Ages that allowed, in these examples at least, the wonder of mermaids to inhabit the world of bishops. To what extent, then, might we use the many richly crafted objects mentioned in the description of the wedding chapel in Jean's text that we looked at in number 6 on the handout to understand Melusine and the particularly wondrousness of her features? To be sure, we have many tools at our disposal to make sense of the complex character of Melusine. Different versions of the story recorded in literary texts for potentially divergent audiences. The prose version by Jean d'Arras, the one that I'm talking about from 1393, and the text in verse by Coudrat, another author, written in 1401. The manuscript tradition and its various readings, manuscript illuminations, and printed images. But what would happen, and this is my question for you today, what would happen if we looked at other material evidence, at cultural objects like those mentioned in the passage we just considered? In particular, sculpted images, gospel books, and lavish textiles. It is important to note here that following historians of material culture generally, I understand material objects, in this case, for me, it's those represented in literary texts, I'm not looking at actual physical objects, but that I understand those material objects to be more than mere objects. Very often material objects point to affective, social, cultural, and economic relationships among people, or in my case, among literary characters. These objects may be utilitarian, they may be decorative, but they are also often cultural actors in a larger narrative, and that's what I want to try to get at today. What is it about the material objects in number 6 on the handout that might mark Melusine as both an icon of courtliness and a potential outsider to that very system? To answer this question will require moving back in time long before the 14th century when Jean d'Arras composed the Roman de Melusine, and it will require considering an expanded geographical context in which to position Melusine, drawing on some of the widespread locations figured in Jean d'Arras' text. I would like to look first at Poitou, home of the historical Lusignan family, where Melusine in this story first appears. She builds monasteries and abbeys and castles and thrives as a mother and a very astute politician. And consider some early medieval examples from Poitou of what our quote, number 6, calls image. I take those to be images sculpted in stone. So in this case, they'll be Romanesque carvings on capitals. We will then move to medieval Armenia. I know it seems like a stretch, but there's a reason to do this, where Melusine's son, Guy, in the narrative, rules as a king. And look there at illuminations in medieval Armenian gospel books. And then in the end, I want to return to France and consider some representations of textiles that are sculpted on capitals in the cloister of Saint-Denis, just outside of Paris, the burial place of medieval French kings. So we will be traveling in this sense, then, in the course of this talk, from medieval France to the east, or to Outre-mer, as they call it in Old French, and then back again to France. But first, a word about textiles. I have argued in Courtly Love Undressed that the typical courtly lady in many 12th and 13th century Old French literary texts is actually defined as Western and courtly by the Islamicate and foreign name textiles she wears and uses. Silks from Damascus, Baghdad, and Alexandria to the east, along with silks coming from Almeria in Al-Andalus, or Muslim Spain, as Sharon Kinoshita and Olivia Constable have amply shown. Even Chrétien's assessment of Marie de Champagne's courtly worth in terms of costly silk cloth points to the commercial trade in the city of Troyes that was fostered by Marie's husband, Henri le Libéral, where domestically produced wool and linen, among other products, were sold to Italian merchants who traded foreign silks and gems, many derived from trade with lands to the east, especially after the Third Crusade in 1189. The Melusine, too, I wish to argue here, is positioned as a Western-Eastern hybrid figure, marked by costly textiles and prized gems, but in a significantly different way from the heroines in earlier Arthurian romances, not only because she has at times a tail and can fly, but more importantly, because her presumed foreignness, if we want to call it that, results from complex patterns of intermarriage that position her squarely between the familiar Lusignan territories of Poitou and the more remote and unfamiliar lands of Armenia and neighboring Albania, as we will see. We know that from 1189 on, the historical Lusignan family forged dynastic relations with the East by marrying a series of Armenian princesses. On this model, Jean d'Arras recounts the adventures of Melusine's son, Guy, who becomes king of Armenia through marriage. But Jean d'Arras also hints at the foreignness of Melusine herself, I think, when she's introduced to the wedding guests by an ornately clad knight who explains that before the heroine married and became Melusine de Lusignan, and this is a name we hear constantly throughout the text, she was called something else. She was called Melusine d'Albanie, Melusine of Albania. For the counts of Poitiers represented in Jean's text, the kingdom of Albania appears to be unfamiliar, distant, and unknown, much like Melusine herself. Even after the announcement that Melusine is from Albanie, Raymond's followers continue to inquire about her lineage and her origins. Different from Raymond's own father, who married, we are told, into an established local family, and that's number 7 on the handout, the nobles of this land gave him a high-born noble woman, sister of the Count of Poitiers, as a wife. Raymond, on the other hand, is marrying outside the known families of the local area, but also possibly, I think, outside of Europe altogether. Family members accuse him of being estrange, or strange, or foreign, or distant. That's number 8 on the handout. My good cousin, Raymond, said the Count, you have become so estranged from us in marrying this woman, such a stranger to us, so different from us, that you decide to marry and we know nothing of it until the wedding day. In Coutret's version of the tale and in most English and modern French translations, Albanie has been taken to mean Scotland, and there are reasons for that, but I would like to suggest that there might be other possible readings of this place, Albanie, that would situate it much further to the east. Huh. Somebody messed with my pages, and I'm embarrassed to say it was me. Okay. Much further to the east, well beyond Europe, toward modern-day Albania and Greece, or even adjacent to the more distant Armenia in eastern Turkey. I think this is a possibility worth considering. Look at this map. This is Ptolemy's map. So it's a second century map that has then been refabricated in the 13th century, rediscovered and remapped. So here you have at the bottom Greater Armenia, and right next to it on the upper left is a country called Albania. This is a map of, and these are from Robert Hewison's Atlas of Armenia, Historical Atlas of Armenia. This is a later version of the same map. It's Armenia in the 4th century, and you have Armenia down below, and still Albania persists as the country that's described immediately adjacent to it. These maps continue through the 10th century, and then the word Albania drops out. But we do know that from Roman times on, Albania was understood to be in close proximity with Armenia. So Jean Dallas gives us a further clue near the end of the tale. After concluding his brief account of the test undergone by the king of Armenia, Jean explains that the kings of two realms, Armenia and Albania, are not only related to each other, but also to the Lusignan line. And that's number 9 on the handout. I have finished speaking about the kings of Armenia. Their story is concluded because it is now obvious that they are descended from the noble lineage of King Elinas of Albania. That was Melusine's father. And from Lusignan. So let me just say that again. I've finished speaking about the Armenian kings because they are descended from the noble King Elinas of Albania and also from Lusignan. Melusine's ties to the East would then descend from her father's lineage in Albania, which produced Armenian kings who also descended from Lusignan. In Jean's text, Melusine and her sons then form a kind of linchpin that helps fold Eastern dynastic power into Western court life. This is, in fact, precisely what the historical Lusignan family did from 1189 on, marrying princesses not from Albania, but its closest neighbor, Armenia. Historically, the lineal ties between Armenia and France are marked perhaps most notably when the last Armenian king, Leon VI, dies in Paris in 1393, the very year that our text, the Roman de Melusine, was written. He was called the Latin King of Armenia and was entombed at the convent of the Celestins, a burial site for French royalty in Paris, and later moved to the royal pantheon in the Basilica of Saint-Denis just outside Paris. If anyone's been there, you can see him, he's still there. This king of Armenia was Jean de Lusignan. He was born of a Cypriot father and an Armenian mother. His death marks the end of a long line of intermarriages between Lusignan and Armenian family lines that extends from the end of the 12th through the close of the 14th century. So, now let's look at some material culture. Let's turn to the area of Poitou and the natal lands of the Lusignan family and to specific sites that are mentioned in Jean's text. This is a map that you cannot read, I apologize. But Lusignan is right near the middle. Let's see. So Lusignan is right up there. Poitiers is further to the north. And then as we move west, you start seeing in this map, in the lower right-hand corner, for example, you can see Vouvant, Mervant, Parthenay, Maillezais, all these places that are mentioned repeatedly in the story of Melusine. So I want to look at some material culture in this particular area. In the towns that Jean Dallas mentions in his text, as well as other Poitou-Vin locations, we find a particular taste for the decorative, whether vegetal, floral, or animal, in fantastic and often hybrid combinations. We also find a concerted emphasis on the depiction of mermaids, or what the French call sirènes poissons. These mermaids appeal on one level to the popular imagination, and in the case of Poitou, they have close ties to local folk tales depicting beguiling water fairies. I'll show you one of them. And those water fairies become associated in the local folklore with Melusine herself. This aspect of Melusine as a water sprite or a siren has been amply documented by Laurence Arflanquenaire as it appears in Latin. She looks at the Latin accounts of Walter Map, Geoffroy d'Auxerre, Gervaise of Tilbury. So consider the following images. This is from Parthenay le Vieux. It's a 12th century Romanesque sculpture, and we have two mermaids. The female is on the right, and then the male is a mermaid and a merman. Here's another one. This is very common to have two mermaids together, either one mermaid with a double tail or two mermaids, each with a tail going off to the side. This one is actually in the area of Aquitaine. It's at La Sauve Majeure. It's from 1120. This is from Chauvigny, which is very near Poitiers, where you have the mermaid. You can't really see her tail very well. I unfortunately cut it out of the photo, but the tail curves around and is held in the mouth of the bird next to her. So she's accompanied by these two kind of fantastic bird creatures. Depending on other creatures surrounding them, medieval mermaids can convey either the local and the familiar, or the distant and the unknown. Consider Saint-Germain-des-Prés. This is in the center of Paris. It's from 1050. And all the gold that's been put on here is from the 16th century, but the original capital carving still remains. But you can see how familiar and everyday this is. It's a mermaid family. There's the merman there, there's the woman next to him, there's even a small mer child, and they're swimming around in what could be local waters with fish. Here the mermaid appears in the company of realistically depicted fish. They're often holding fish in these kinds of images or swimming with them so that they convey the image of the familiar and the everyday. More often, however, mermaids appear in medieval capital carvings in the company of exotic creatures like centaurs. So the centaurs on the far right, the mermaids in the middle, it's a little bit hard to discern her tail. She has a fish tail. But there are so many tendrils of plants also winding around her. But she is a mermaid with a fish tail. And this is more common, to have medieval mermaids depicted in the company of centaurs as representations of distant races or monsters. This is Notre-Dame de la Dorade in Toulouse. It used to be, so this is the second half of the 12th century. It was in the cloister, it's now in the Musée des Augustins, Toulouse. Melusine differs most significantly from all of these stone carvings of mermaids, of course, because of her tail. She is said to have not a fish tail, but a snake tail. It's described as being 15 feet long and thick as a barrel. So she has an enormous snake tail. The difference is significant. The snake tail tends to position Melusine closer to the exotic and distant lands, I think. Lands filled with monsters and different races, places depicted at times as containing even camels and elephants. So we might want to consider an image like this. This is from the Menarius Bible, an English Bible, dated to 1175. You can see in the top register, I think I have a close-up of this, so to the far left is a centaur in the very top register. Then there are two mer people with enormous snake-like tails, not fish tails. Then another centaur. Then some creatures of other lands who have the enormous feet as umbrellas covering their heads. And then an elephant accompanying them. Now, the mermaids we've been considering in Poitou, all those carvings we saw of mermaids with fish tails, differ in another significant respect from Melusine. They have no wings. They're really like fish with human bodices and heads. But other mermaids do. Other mermaids do have wings. They tend to be bird sirens as opposed to fish sirens. And although bird sirens are very rare in French Romanesque capital carvings, especially in the area around Poitou that we've been looking at, they dominate in medieval Armenian gospel books. This is a quote from an Armenian art historian who says, a distinguished Armenian art historian who says, it is rare, in fact, to find an Armenian gospel book or Bible where this fabulous creature, the bird siren, does not appear at least once. Either in chapter headings, initial letters, or marginal images, like this one, this is a marginal image. Gospel books from Armenian Cilicia in particular, and that's 13th century Armenia that was located on the Mediterranean, have an especially rich repertoire. Some examples that we might consider This one from the 15th century gospel book. It's held in Antelias, Lebanon, which is one of the holy sees of the Armenian Apostolic Church. But it's the head of a woman with some kind of a crown or a hat, striped wings, clearly bird-like wings, and a bird-like tail. Here's another example. This is from the Armenian Patriarchate in Jerusalem. This manuscript is dated to 1262, and you can see that there are fantastic creatures above the human. It's Eusebius. It's a letter to Eusebius at the bottom there. But around him, there are lions with human heads. Below the lions, it's hard to determine, but it's some sort of a stag creature on the right. But the two at the top are the ones I'm interested in. They're women-headed sirens that are bird sirens. They're wearing a hat. They have clear bird wings, plumage on the chest, and then bird tails. Here's another one we might consider up in the upper corners, the upper right and left-hand corners. This is not a great image, but again, it's a woman-headed bird. These have very long, it's a peacock tail. There are peacocks in the top register above, and the peacock tails there are repeated in these birds coming down the sides of the page. Now, a number of bird sirens, that's a lousy detail, we don't need to worry about that. A number of bird sirens bearing a female head with wings and plumage also have snake tails, and that's what you see here. So that you have on either edge of the manuscript page, you have a woman's head, a bird body, bird wings, and instead of a bird tail, even though it has feathers on it, it's in the coiling form of the snake tail. This is another one. This is a gospel book from 1248. So you also see the woman's head with the bird wings with the curving snake tail in the image on either side. And I think I have one final one. This is Gospel of Mark that's dated to 1231. And here again, you see the woman's head, the bird wings, and the curving snake tail. In this case, the curving snake tail turns into a plant tendril, a plant motif at the bottom. But it's clearly not a bird tail. Now, there is a detail on these wings that's important, that if you see on the wings, they're little round circles, sort of at the shoulder level, that are like pearls. And this is where I want to connect everything we've been talking about up until this point to textiles. What about textiles? These winged creatures in the Gospel of Mark have a distinct element of purling on their wings, as I was mentioning. It's actually thought to derive from textile decoration. The earliest example of this kind of decorative purling is found on the exterior sculptures on the Church of the Holy Cross at Agtamar. Has anyone been there? This has actually become a site of those who visit Western Turkey, sometimes go to Lake Van, which is in Anatolia. But anyway, I haven't been there, but it's a 10th century church that has lots of ornate sculpture on the outside. This is a winged creature that's hard to see here, but it's a griffin. It has lion's feet, lion's body pretty much, but it also has wings. And then it has this incredible detail of, they're called punctured pearls or inverted pearls. So they're not pearls sticking out, but it's a way of representing pearls. And Dernersesian, the Armenian scholar that I referred to earlier, thinks that this motif comes from Sasanian textiles. Mm-hmm. She points to this image, and then there's another creature facing it on this side. So another kind of exotic hybrid creature with a goat's head end. But you can see, again, that there's this punctured pearl motif on the wing, as it was in this Gospel to St. Mark, but all around the edge here, and moving into that portion. So Derrida Sessian makes the case that this purling detail and also the palmette patterns, the things that look like, you can see them better in the other one, these kind of palmette patterns and these patterns come from textiles. And that what she alleges is that the wings, these patterns on the wings, derive from Sasanian textile designs that were perhaps absorbed by and repeated in Islamic textiles that were circulating in medieval Armenia. I don't have one of those textiles, but I have this. This is an Egypto-Arabic tiraz textile of blue silk on linen from the Metropolitan in New York. It's from the 12th century. But you can see how this purling pattern, this is a flat version of a representation of pearls. So in the examples from Akhtamar, those sculptures on the outside of the church, textiles are used to mark, and this is an important point I want to make, they're not there because they're marking monsters, but fantastic imaginative creatures from distant eras and far off locations. They are mythic and legendary and marvelous, or to use a word we have seen repeatedly in Jean Dahas's Melusine, they are wondrous creatures. These heavily adorned creatures are beautiful, like the bejeweled textiles they emulate. Perhaps some of the best European examples of similarly adorned sirens occur in the 12th century capitals from the now destroyed cloister at Saint-Denis. One in particular survives at the Musée National du Moyen Âge in Paris. Maybe some of you have seen this. It's prominently displayed. It's a capital that has four of these siren figures, one on each corner. It's from 1145 to 60. So similar to the images from the Sicilian Armenian manuscripts we have been looking at, this bird siren has wings. Can't see the whole wing, but she has wings. She has a woman's head. It is part of a larger group of 12th century capitals formerly in the cloister, all depicting bird sirens. Some are paired with monsters. Others are paired simply with other sirens. The sirens, however, I want to argue, are not merely decorative carvings of fanciful, mythological, or imaginary bird creatures. They, like Melusine, are lavishly clad. Elements that might appear at first to be purely decorative, like the edging on the siren's feathered wing, or the motif encircling her neck, or stretching across her bird-like chest, are distinctive textile motifs that also occur on sculpted representations of medieval royal and liturgical garments. This is a king who is now in the Metropolitan in New York, but what I want you to look at is the diamond pattern. Let's see, can we see it? I can see it better. So this zigzag pattern is important. This pattern is important. Both of them appear here. So she has, instead of one zigzag, she has a double zigzag motif. But this diamond pattern that appears on the king's garment is also used to tie this siren to the other siren. There he is. So this is the diamond pattern, this is a zigzag pattern, and then this is a double purling pattern. She has it in single. It's single pearls here, there, and around her neck. So I had looked at these images of sirens for many years, and it never occurred to me that they had anything to do with textiles. Most art historians talk about them as monstrous, as decorative, as exotic. But looking at those Armenian manuscript illuminations, I began thinking of how textiles might be represented in a lot of different ways. Then I walked around to the back part of this capital And I saw for the first time that there are snake tails attaching these two. There are four sirens here. So there's a siren here. This is her. This is the textile design. This is the feather. And then it's hard to see, but there's one snake tail curving up there and another one curving up in the other direction. So we have here all the different elements. We have the woman's head, we have the bird wing, we have the snake tail, and we have the textile motifs coming together. Art historians have tended to describe these hybrid creatures on Romanesque sculpture, like the ones we've been considering, as purely decorative. Often combined with twisting plant motifs, tails become tendrils, composite bodies arranged in patterns and rhythms as distinct from the historiated capitals, which portray events in the life of Christ or tell a biblical story. The insistence that the images of mermaids or sirens on capitals, whether in Poitou or Paris, are purely decorative makes little sense when we consider the textile motifs that adorn them. To be sure, textiles themselves are often decorative. We know this. Actual textiles serve many functions, of course, as clothing, as markers of social position and wealth, but also as literal currency. Silk was used in the Middle Ages, as I'm sure many of you know, as money. Textiles are, in addition, a key marker of the technological superiority in the Arab and Byzantine worlds that produced them, and of the distant lands whose names they often carry in medieval literary texts. We learn of silk from Baghdad, silk from Alexandria, silk from Damascus, silk from Almeria. In the case of Jean d'Ars' Melusine, I would argue, and this is the point I really want to make, that decoration matters. It says that Melusine is strange and foreign in an international context, a hybrid from both Lusignan and Albania. She's not a Saracen princess. We hear a lot about those in medieval literary texts. She's already a Christian, and she says so over and over. But she is a politically productive, cross-cultural wonder from a trans-Mediterranean world of commerce and trade that extended from the Levant to medieval France. That's just another image where you can see the snake tails, and there she is again. In Jean d'Ars' text, we witness Melusine's cultural hybridity then, long before we see her snake tail in the bath. We see it first not in her naked body, which is wondrous and marvelous, but when she's fully and lavishly clothed. That's the story, I think, that material culture in sculpture and manuscript illumination and textiles helps to tell. The story of Melusine as a cultural and geographic hybrid, standing not only between the sacred and the secular realms, as indicated in the quote with which we began, but also carrying the hybrid lineage of an Albanian Lusignan, not unlike King Leon VI, the last Armenian king, who carries an Armenian Lusignan heritage and is called the Latin King of Armenia. He is now buried in the Abbey Church of Saint-Denis, as we said before, where during the Middle Ages at least, at least one of the sirens in the cloister was this one, a textile-laden, bejeweled, snake-tailed woman. That's it. Thank you. I'm happy to take questions if anyone has questions. It's a long haul, I know. Yeah.
So I noticed that you said you talked about how she was giving these material objects were relating her to like Alexander the Great when she was giving jewels
because of generosity.
Yeah, and how she was related to Morgan Le Fay through the embroidery. Now she's related to both of them distantly, correct? Linus, his son was the grandfather.
Yeah.
No,
you're absolutely right. There is a sense in which her children are related to Alexander the Great's descendants. And that's one of the weird, I mean, this story is all about creating false lineage or fictive lineage or desired lineage or imagined lineage. And that's one of the emphases, you're absolutely right, that's made, is that she and her line descend from Alexander the Great. And in this period, what could be better? He's the best ancestor to have.
And then Morgan Le Fay is related on her mother's side, right? Or at least related to the story on her mother's
yeah.
side, which is like, because doesn't it say somewhere that her mother is related to the Lady of the Lake?
That I don't remember. Melusine's mother is Plessine, and
yeah.
she's a fairy. So, as many of you know, this category of fairies in the Middle Ages are sometimes all seen as somehow magically related to one another. I don't remember an actual lineage coming from Morgan. Is that which is that
I
in there?
I had some criticism on this that claimed that when they go to Avalon,
mm-hmm.
When Plessine flees
yes.
after her, you know, Alliance walks in on her giving birth.
Right.
And
the daughters are born yeah. there.
And then they go to Avalon, and someone linked to the Lady of the Lake and claimed that it was a lineage. I don't remember which scholar it was, but
I don't know that. It's possible. But
so.
I think the connection with Alexander the Great is more important because of his geographic location
yeah.
and because of all the trade that was happening in the medieval Mediterranean. But see, this is the problem with this text. It's in one sense, it's all about the Hundred Years' War between England and France. And it is. I mean, so much of it is about that war and about those locations. So my reading is an attempt to say, but wait, there is the eastward looking part of it as well. And here's how this material culture might give us an inroad to thinking about that. There's a great book, La Tentation de l'Orient. Does anybody know that book? By Gaulier Bourgassa. She talks about how Jean d'Arras is trying to create a legacy for Jean de Berry that is connected to the old Lusignan dynasty and fortune during the crusading era. So 200 years earlier, he's. I mean, it's great if you're a writer of fiction. You can take history and just kind of twist it around to, in all kinds of pretzel formations. Anyway, yeah.
So is this idea of estrangeté, is that connected to Orientalism in some way? Maybe this is...
Yeah.
How you think about that.
Orientalism, though, has, for Edward Said and many others, has a derogatory
sure.
connotation. I think in this text, because he quotes Gervase of Tilbury all the time, who says, you know, the strange and the different is wonderful. It's marvelous. It's something we should allow ourselves to enjoy. We should, you know, soak it up and not condemn it as different or other. So I think it's the word is being redefined in this text as marvelous in a good sense.
Right, because the word noble is used twice. Right? La chapelle noblement armée et les livres tant nobles qu'on pourrait souhaiter
yes.
is connected to the étrange.
Yes,
and
yes.
There's kind of an emphasis on the connection.
There is, yeah, absolutely. So courtly nobility, in my reading, is completely infused with Eastern culture, whether it wants to recognize it or not, but it comes up in many of these medieval romances that the courtly ladies in particular, and for me it's really through clothing, they're already Eastern. They look Eastern, they dress in an Eastern way, their kind of identity results from Eastern material goods. And in the text more than, and this is something that I really love about reading literature. So when you read The Romance of the Rose, for example, or any number of literary texts, you are constantly reading physical descriptions of 25 kinds of silk. If you're looking at a piece of silk, you don't get that same kind of repetition of this is silk from Baghdad, silk from Damascus, silk from Egypt, silk from Almeria. Whereas in the literary text, the words keep beating you over the head.
There's a geographic attachment to
the geography
yeah.
that you can't escape. Whereas if you're looking at a piece of silk in a museum, which I also love to do, it's silk, first and foremost. It's color. It's reflecting light. But it doesn't point to a specific geographic location in and of itself. Whereas the only way you get the silk in the text, or many times, is through with a geographical tag on it. Yeah.
It also, I guess, ties into the prologue and also the discussion of the bird sirens.
Uh-huh.
I know John Darras says something about how people who can't understand the text, if they haven't traveled, if they haven't, you know, seen these other parts of the world, they're less likely to like understand the text and not likely to believe it.
Uh-huh.
And so that kind of, I was wondering, do you think there's definitely a connection there between the fact that it seems almost like Melusine is being linked to these bird sirens that are much more commonly seen?
Absolutely, because who travels in this text? It's Melusine's sons. One of them is sent to Bohemia, one of them is sent to Luxembourg, one of them is sent, becomes the king of Cyprus, one of them becomes the king of Armenia. She has 10 sons. So they are the characters, of all the characters in the novel, they're the ones who are traveling. And they are also the ones who are disfigured, I don't want to say it that way, who have interesting anatomical variations. They're hybrids in many ways, like she is. And so it's not that they're, you know, there's a clerical voice in this text which condemns all kinds of things. I'm trying to read around that to what else is there. So, because that's not the dominant voice. It comes in very loudly in a few points. But they're the ones who travel. They're the ones who become strangers in a strange land. They're also the best knights ever. They are the ones who succeed in battle. They establish kingdoms. They build nations. They travel. Yes. So Jean Darras is trying to say that, you know, people, you know, having a broader perspective is an asset, not a liability. It's also a way for Jean de Berry to inherit lands that he really has no claim to. Because the Lusignan line, I don't know how many of you know this, but the Lusignan line in Lusignan has died out by this time. There are no more Lusignan. And so he has to claim, fake as it is, lineal descent from the Lusignan from the crusading era in the East. Luckily, there are lots of chronicles and documents and texts to draw on. Yeah.
I think one of the really interesting things about the Melusine text is exactly what you said, that there's this, she produces all of these offspring who are very hybrid, and yet the text doesn't necessarily condemn them.
No,
they're successful. It kind of produce, you know, it's almost a sort of interesting genetic study. Like if you marry this to this, and that really struck me as we're looking at this image, that we see several fabrics that are joined together. Right, mm-hmm. That we've got a narrow woven band mm-hmm. that's marrying kind of a diaper woven texture on the breast piece.
So you think this is a textile too? I wondered about that. I mean,
that looks exactly like a piece of 12th century reproduction diaper woven that I have upstairs. If you want to look at it.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. It's just that sometimes, well. You know, this is the whole question. Is it used sometimes for feathers and sometimes for textiles? Or
the feathers look like diamond lozenge twill to me.
Yeah, it's like a hybrid textile feather.
Yeah, I mean, I see four distinct textiles there that are sewn together.
Yes,
but
okay.
I think as I wanted to expand that in terms of the fashion that begins very tentatively in the 12th century but is very strong by the 14th, of the codam, of showing... Uh-huh. lineage and the sort of genetic contributions to the family by sewing two different textiles together show the mother and the, you know, the mother's
and
line and the father's line.
Right. Yes.
That you could express
lineage,
like dynastic or genetic hybridity. Genetic is a very modern term, of course, but you know what I mean? That you're showing marriage through sewing two textiles together, or sometimes four, or sometimes eight. You know,
uh-huh.
sometimes you get into a real multiplication.
Right.
So I think that there's maybe some play with that as you're showing these fantastic beasts that are bred from multiple species.
Uh-huh.
I think that supports your argument. I think that's exciting.
Yeah.
Voilà.
Yes.
You talked about... these creatures winning too many battles and emphasized their success in their empires.
Yes.
So are them presented as like half human and half
mm-hmm.
whatever?
All kinds of things. One has a lion's paw on his face.
is it like, is this distinction to make sure that the right attributions, like their success is going to be attributed just like to these creatures, avoiding like mistakes, like avoiding attributing the success of the battles and their empires to...
You mean they're distinctive so you can recognize them?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the way it plays out in the text. They are distinctive. And there are some opponents who say, oh, isn't it unfortunate that, I can never remember who has which characteristic, but Jeffrey has three eyes or something, because he's such an amazing knight and he wins all the battles and he's the fleur de la chevalerie. But I think the message that's being conveyed to the reader is that those people are misreading, that they're thinking that these exterior characteristics, these hybrid characteristics might have a negative valuation or impair the knight in some way or diminish his power, when in fact it seems in everybody, in Melusine and all her sons, that the hybridity increases their power and their success and their ability to be politically effective. What else? Anything else I could...
I have just a question about the Lusignan. Do you know about the court of Cyprus, the Lusignan Cyprus?
Uh-huh. Peter the First. And
right. So how does this connect to this story? They're very important musically.
Yes. So here's the thing. And in the Gaudier Bougassa book I mentioned earlier, she says this specifically. Isn't it odd that there was this very powerful, flourishing kingdom in Cyprus run by Lusignan, and Jean d'Arras doesn't mention it? So he's picking and choosing which part of Lusignan history he wants to use. Why he doesn't do it is, there are many possible answers. I don't think anyone really knows. But it's a very good question. You know, the short answer being, it doesn't feature in this text.
Right, there's going to be a reason.
Yeah. Well, someone can figure that out.
There's a manuscript that's very famous from the early 15th century that was produced for the Lusignan court that transmits an entire repertory of European music. It's now been technically redated to the 1430s, this manuscript, which is shockingly late, but would suggest that something about the Lusignan was going on full steam in the 1430s as a political dynastic.
I think they control Cyprus until 1489 or so, late, right?
Yeah, it's in the 15th century.
Yeah.
Is it that one?
Uh-huh. But that's very interesting. So what's happening in 1430? I don't know.
Well, it was produced in, not in Cyprus, but in probably in Italy, so it's very cute.
Oh, wow. Well, here's a dissertation topic for someone.
Do you see a background to the bird siren with the snake tail going back through history?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't looked back further. John, any thoughts about bird sirens?
Well,
historically,
they're very ubiquitous, and you find them all around, in carvings, of course, Romanesque carvings, but on down into Sericords and so on, in English and French stuff. And some people have tried to trace them to various sorts of Assyrian motifs, these winged lions and so on. But I think Jacqueline Leclerc-Marx's book on sirens has some pretty good account of the pre-Romanesque history of
That's a very thoroughgoing account of both the bird sirens and the fish sirens. Jacqueline Leclerc. Well, she was Jacqueline Leclerc for a long time. Now she's Leclerc Marx, I guess.
And what about the snake tails?
The local fishing industry.
Well, thank you, everyone.
What